Do you struggle in school but have big dreams? Are you great with people and know how to build strong relationships? You have a strong work ethic but you don't want to spend 4 to 6 years in college? If this is you, then you'll want to tune in to Jerry's story. Jerry Rosengarten is an entrepreneur and the inventor of the leisure suit. He'll share how he went from fashion to building hotels. He'll give tips on who you need to surround yourself with and what you need to do to find success without a college degree. Learn from someone who did this all with an undiagnosed medical condition, which he only discovered in his 50s. I'm your host, Junaid Iqbal, a certified career coach and professional resume writer. I've written over 600 resumes for people in high school all the way to the C-suite across all industries. With over 290 recommendations at the bottom of my LinkedIn profile, I'm also the founder of NoDegree.com and on a mission to show that a college degree isn't necessary for success. I interview people who will share strategies to break into the top careers without the crushing debt. Let's get started.
No degree, no problem. Any problem, we can solve them. LinkedIn insomnia keeps us evolving. We're growing in the
Welcome to another episode of the No Degree Podcast. I want to personally thank you for tuning in and supporting our show. If you haven't yet, hit that follow or subscribe button. I encourage you, don't keep this to yourself. Share these inspiring stories with your friends, invite them to subscribe, and connect with us on social media. So today I have on Jerry Rosengarten. What do you do?
First of all, it's...
Gerald.
Friends call me Jerry.
Okay. So we're not friends, okay? So you're Gerald, but, I guess, right?
No. You can be... I start to feel an affinity towards you, fine. So it's okay.
I get a pass.
But the book is Gerald Rosengarten.
All right, so...
Because that's really my name.
Yeah.
And it's like, I guess I had to put it on the book.
Yeah, no, okay.
That's the proper thing to do. I don't know why, but it is.
Okay.
In any case, what was your question?
What do you do? Like...
What do I do? A lot of different things. Over my life, I've done a lot of different things. That's the reason the name of the book is Jump on a Train.
Oh, I like that.
Okay, because every project I've done, it's been like jumping on a train. I didn't necessarily know what I was doing in most of the ones that I jumped on the train.
I like that.
And I took it to the end. Each one of them I took to the end. And that's over a lot of years. And it's been very successful.
Now, what were some of the things you did, just high level?
Leisure suit in the 70s, uh-huh. Which became a phenomenon to itself. I started loft development.
Okay.
I made a loft medical building. I built 2 17-story buildings in the city. One of those was the Bowery Hotel.
Wow.
I was in mini storage. And I built the largest solar farm in Long Island. I was ahead of everybody with regard to energy.
Yeah.
I built the first greenhouse in Southampton. And that's what led to the solar farm. Because I really wanted to build a community of greenhouses, but the community wouldn't let me.
Oh, man. All right. So before we dive into some of the deeper stories and we go into like the book, how was high school like for you and would you want to be in high school?
First of all, we can start before high school because I was dyslexic.
Okay.
And I am dyslexic. And I didn't find out until I was 50.
Okay.
So I had a lot of difficulty in school. The only good things I had in school was I had a couple of mentors who helped me through it. I got through 2 years of college, and then it was just too much. So I dropped out of college and started looking for a job. Actually, I shouldn't say that because I had a job. I had 2 jobs, even at some points, 3 jobs through high school and those 2 years of college.
Now, how was it living with dyslexia? Like, how were you perceived? How were your internal feelings towards it, like when you were struggling?
First, when it wasn't discovered. People didn't talk about dyslexia. I don't even know if dyslexia even was a thing then. So it was just a matter of being slow, stupid, not trying hard enough, and stuff like that, which is what I grew up with. So I had to look for other things.
Now, what kind of jobs did you have throughout high school? And what was your first job?
I was in the men's clothing store.
Okay.
And I actually was in 2 men's clothing stores. like Thursday and Friday, I worked in one, Monday and Tuesday, I worked in the other. And I worked in a, I'm trying to remember the name, Jan's, which was an ice cream parlor. So I kept very busy, but in part taking much of the stuff that school, you know, you do in school, because I had this, well, inferiority complex or something. Yeah. Based upon the fact of what everyone was telling me. But that changed, obviously.
Now, you went to college.
For 2 years, yeah.
So when did you say, hey, you know what? This is not for me. I got to do something else.
Well, actually, they said it.
Okay.
I didn't know this. I was at a city college. I didn't know that you had to be over two average, a 2 point or whatever it was. And I was a 2 point and a little lower than a 2 point. And they said, we're not letting you kind of come back next year.
Oh, wow.
And I said, what? And that's exactly what happened. I must admit, I played around a lot in college, fraternities and stuff like that. So maybe I would have got over that too.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
So now you're not coming back. What's going through your mind?
Well, I was going through depression at that point because it was a slap in the face. I didn't expect it at all. I don't really want to get into it, but it's in the book.
Yeah.
Okay. It's kind of like, let me give you a preface. I was very heavy. That added only to the problem. So I started to take diet pills, which quadrupled the problem.
Oh, wow.
But I lost the weight. And that's what happened.
Now, what was your next move in terms of employment?
Well, I was working in the men's clothing stores. I kept on working there. One of the owners of the store, there were two owners of this store, and he wanted me to buy him out of the store. As a kid, I had no money. I mean, it was a ridiculous concept, but he was an older man, and he was, you know, and he said he would fund me and all this other stuff. And I thought about it for a long time because it was an attractive offer in its own way, but I wasn't ready. I just wasn't ready. I wouldn't survive. Yeah, so I passed that. Then I decided to go into wholesale because I saw all the salesmen who would come in with their bags, would leave with orders, and it was a license to steal, actually. So I watched that. I said, that would be interesting to do. And I started to pursue it, and I realized it's all nepotism. One father would pass it on to the next kid and so forth and so on. And so it was hard to break. It would have been hard to break into it. So I went into textiles. No, actually, wait a second. Before I went into textiles, I went into women's dresses.
Okay.
And they were half-size dresses, which I had no idea what that meant. But really what it meant was you took a curtain and you made a dress. They were humongous dresses, right? And I was selling to Macy's. And really nice, petite buyers. And they kind of like snubbed me because I was selling half-size dresses. And that led into textiles.
Well, let's talk about textiles.
Textiles was a trip too, and a learning experience. Because it was the first time I really got screwed. But I had said to this company that I was with at the time that I could sell the fabrics they were making, which was women's wear fabrics, to the men's wear trade. And the head of that company said, you're full of shit. You can't do that. I said, no, I can. Eventually, after about 6 months of plaguing him with this, I was at that point just cutting swatches for the salesman. And I plagued him. And finally, he said, all right, go up. But I'm going to reduce your salary, and I'm going to give you a commission over $150,000, give you a 6% commission. But right now, your salary is half.
And what was your salary then? your salary then, if you don't mind sharing?
I think it was about $75.
Okay.
This is in 70.
Yeah. So $75, was it monthly salary? Is it?
No, it was weekly. Okay.
So it went to 30. It went to 150 to 75, or it went from 75 to 37 and a half?
The second one.
Okay, wow. So you went from 75 to 37 and a half. Okay.
So I find, you know, and then I got a mentor within that company, Saul Hirsch, who was a great older guy, knew everybody and told great stories. And he said, listen, you're not going to be able to support yourself at 37. Put in for lunch. I said, okay. He can't not pay you for lunch because you're working for sales. So I said, okay. And I found a fabric that I took up to the menswear trade. Now, I had all this experience. I was still working in the clothing stores, all right? I found this fabric, and there was a tailor in one of the stores who was a master tailor. He was also a nasty guy. But when I asked him to make a suit out of this fabric, he fell in love with me because I may be the first person who said, you know, make something other than alterations, which is what he was doing in the store. So he made a jacket, and I went up for another 4 months or whatever it was, because the menswear industry only bought twice a year. The womenswear industry bought every day. Just about. And I took this fabric up to the menswear, as I said, for like over 4 months, and I was sampling. You know what sampling is?
I guess trying different things, right? You're showing other people.
No. In the textile industry or in the menswear industry, they would take 2 yards and make the jacket. So they were sampling the fabric for what they would, for their line. And the boss would say to me, look at me, and it was very gruff. Those days. I mean, it was just impossible. He looked at it and says, those are samples. What does that mean? Because he's under the impression that when you sample someone in the womenswear industry, within a week, 2 weeks, you get an order. So I wasn't doing any business at all. All I was doing was sampling to the point that he was going to let me go, right? And then the orders started coming in. And the orders came in droves. Within a matter of 2 months, I passed the quota that I was supposed to get the percentage. And then at that point, he said, let's go up and look at your customers. I want to see who you're dealing with. And now he had his arm on my shoulder and all this other stuff. He takes me up there, and they all give him a cold shoulder. Because I had told stories about the place and stuff like that. And I was a fair-haired guy because I was selling them a fabric that looks like it was good. So I did $1.5 million worth of business that year. He was supposed to give me a 6% commission. Never saw a penny. Yeah. So that's when I planned. First of all, I made sure all my customers got their shipments. And then I left that company and went to Burlington Industries, which I was with for about 2 years. And they weren't nice either.
Well, were they nicer than the other boss?
But one guy, his name is Bill Klotman. Klotman Mills was a major division of Burlington. And one day, and I'm now working for the women's, I'm working for the menswear knit division, which is a vision that I started. Because up until then, there were no knits for menswear, right? And one day, out of the blue, and we're doing a lot of business. Matter of fact, so much business that he comes in and says, we're going to close the division. I said, how could you close the division? We're making a bundle here. How could you close a division? He says, well, you're taken away from all the other divisions. And I said, holy... He said, you got to fire 22 men. I said, make that 23, which was a ballsy thing to do because I really didn't have anything to go to. the funny thing about that was that Burlington didn't have any of their own equipment. The equipment, their fabrics were all jobbed out. So they had other mills making the fabrics. And I was the guy who dealt with those other mills. So it was easy for me to start up a company and use their material, use those mills, to manufacture for the menswear industry.
Are you frustrated with your job search? Are you sending out resume after resume with no callbacks? If so, I have some good news. After 3 years of helping over 400 people land jobs at places like Meta, HubSpot, Google, Twitter, Amazon, Tesla, Disney, Sony, I created a course. In the Get Your Dream Career course, you'll discover best practices for creating a resume that stands out, and you'll also learn how to optimize your job search. It covers every aspect of the job, including resumes, application strategy, networking, LinkedIn profile optimization, interview guidance, and salary negotiation. You will also get a behind-the-scenes view of how recruiters use LinkedIn to find candidates. And of course, you'll get resume and cover letter templates. Get one step closer to your dream job. Sign up at the link in the notes below.
At this point, I made a fabric, I made a garment, and I was showing it to one of my customers, and in walks Clara Hancock. You don't know Clara Hancock. She was the biggest person in the menswear industry because she wrote an article. She wrote a daily article for the Menswear Daily. She comes in, looks at the garment, says, "I like that. Let's call it the leisure suit." And that's how the leisure suit started. Do you know anything about the leisure suit?
No, I'm going to hear from the man himself. Tell me.
It took off like you wouldn't believe. It took over the whole industry for 6 years. And I was in it with I was manufacturing and selling into that trade, which was very good. Except, just like everything else, it got knocked off and knocked off and knocked off. And when things are knocked off, they're made cheaper, not as good, not even, you know, no style, whatever. And that's what happened. That killed that industry, that fashion. The guy who was one of the guys who made the fashion was Johnny Carson, because he started wearing the leisure suit.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was a biggie.
Now, how did it feel to have someone like that wear the leisure suit?
It was gold. It's like a comedian going on the Johnny Carson show and him asking you to sit down, you know, next to him and talk to him. The guy was made then. And this was a very interesting part of my life. And it's an interesting story about that whole era. I enjoyed it while it lasted.
Now, what came next?
Well, I didn't know what I was going to do because I had no business. I really had nothing. I didn't even think I had experience. I had built a mill, a textile mill. I had rented MGM's executive offices for my offices. So this was a big deal. But again, I gave it all back. I made sure all my people were covered and all that stuff. So I realized I knew real estate and I knew possibly building. New York was going under. Lindsay was the mayor, and New York was just falling apart. This was before Ed Koch came in. Do you remember that name?
The Queensboro Bridge.
Okay. Ed Koch came in and he actually changed New York. But in any case, this was prior to that. And luckily I was there prior to that. Manufacturers were leaving New York in droves. Manufacturing buildings were empty. The city didn't know what to do with them. Artists started taking over lofts, like full floors, 20-foot ceilings, stuff like that. And they used to do major artwork in there. But they also started to live there, which was illegal. Any day they could have been kicked out. So I decided to make legal lofts, and not just for artists, but for regular folks. And that's what I did for about 3 years.
Now, how was the reception to that?
That's still going on. People, the desire for lofts. Well, let me put it this way. Conventional apartments are little boxes. Okay. Maybe big boxes or little boxes, but they're basically just boxes. Lofts are cabin spaces, which you have 2,000, 3,000 square feet to build something that's kind of spectacular. And that's what happened. It's still happening. Less because they've gone up so much in value.
Yeah.
So the prices are through the roof.
So you did lofts for a few years. What was like the coolest loft or project that you worked on during that time frame?
I think 59 Fourth Avenue. It was a loft building that was shaped somewhat like a rifle. It went back 175 feet deep. It was 25 feet to 30 foot in the back. The architect told me, don't do it. So I got rid of my architect. My accountant told me not to do it. So I got rid of my accountant. And it turned out really good. These were the high ceilings. It was unusual. I mean, it was a long hallway, but those long hallways became galleries and stuff like that.
Wow, I like that. So you did lofts for a few years. What'd you do after?
I took a loft build. First of all, buildings got out of sight. I couldn't afford the buildings. The buildings just took off. Regular real estate people who used to build buildings started to get into the loft business. And they made legal lofts and so forth. So that was the end of that for me. I got a 40-year lease on a building. So I made it a medical building. And I ended up with about 70 doctors at the end. And that was a good business. That was what I call a drizzler. You know the term drizzler?
No, explain it.
London Fog. You know that company? He was a major raincoat manufacturer for years and years and years. He made a jacket. It was a short jacket. People would play golf in it, and people, you know, wore it just about all the time. And it sold year in, year out, which meant he was making money on that jacket year in, year out. So I called that the drizzler. This building became my drizzler. Of course, it supported all the other stuff I did.
Wow. So what did you use the funding from that to do?
I built a couple of regular buildings, one opposite the Brooklyn Museum. I built a mini storage building. I didn't build it. It existed, and I made it within the inside. I made a studio, a music and film studio, because here I had a space within the building that I acquired for the storage. And I had this large cavernous space of about 18 to 20 foot high, but it ran 170 feet without a column. So anybody who wanted to shoot could shoot that way. Beyonce did a shoot for the Super Bowl for Pepsi in that space.
That is cool.
And then that space got flooded.
Ah.
Sandy knocked it out.
All right. So now, how old are you at this point? So, because we've really gone through a decent portion of your life.
I have no idea.
It's Beyonce, so I guess it could have been in the mid 2000s, right?
Yeah, it was in 2000. Okay. 60, 50 something. Well, 50. Okay. In 50, when I was 50, I was at a party, and they had the 60 Minutes playing on in the background. And I heard a guy on 60 Minutes reading like me, fumbling, really having trouble getting through the sentence. And I said, what is this? And he had dyslexia. And this woman named Helen Erlin had a way of helping people who have a form of dyslexia. She put a colored overlay over the page, and then the guy read fluently. So she was from California. I pulled every favor I could out there to get to her number and to meet her. And I got her into the medical building on the ploy of putting her in one of the offices. But she was looking for it. She didn't take it with it. But if she came to look at it, she had to test me. And she tested me. And it worked.
Now, how did it feel? Because now I could imagine it's like you go back and you think, I wasn't stupid. I wasn't dumb. I wasn't lazy.
But I already determined in my own head I wasn't dumb. I wasn't stupid. You know? That I'd already done. Because I was so far ahead of others in doing the stuff I was doing. And I was doing stuff that no one even thought about. So, I didn't feel stupid. But it was a rude awakening that there was a dyslexia that actually caused what happened to me as a kid. And that was a rude awakening. I used it. I tried to put out a kit for children, a reading kit. I wasn't successful. I didn't have the guts. I was going to say something else. I didn't have the guts to actually really go out on the line and throw everything away and just do that. As a matter of fact, it's in the book, and it's the last chapter of the book, even though in sequence it's a lot earlier. And I plan the sales of the book to be like 50% towards literacy. So I got to get back.
I love that. How did life change after you discovered that you had it and now there's a solution for it?
In all candor, it didn't change. I mean, I had so many habits and so many ways of dealing with things that reading, I started to use the filters, but I was very ingrained in the way I had developed.
What are some systems you developed to get around?
I always forgot my glasses.
I like that.
I would basically say I didn't read that. I'll have to go back and read it. And I had, at that point, I had a lawyer and a secretary and so forth. So that could happen. I don't think there must have been suspicion. But I don't think anybody knows that or knew that until now this book comes out.
Wow, that's interesting. And what are some ways that you cope? Like, I guess learning, you went through mentors, right? What was your form of learning? Because you wouldn't read.
You won't know these names, but Saul, Herb, at different times, helped me deal with what was going on. If you're talking about reading contracts and stuff, that was my brother. Yeah. And my secretary, and stuff like that. They wouldn't read it to me. They'd pull out the bad stuff.
Yeah.
And they go over that bad stuff, and I work it out somehow.
So now let's look back. So were you ever asked if you had a degree in a job interview?
I never had a job interview.
Oh, okay.
I mean...
Or in a business deal.
No.
In a business deal, did that ever come up?
No. Why would it come? It would never come up in a business deal.
Yeah, no. I've seen some weird scenarios where they're like, oh, where'd you go to school? Or...
Oh, yeah. That I'd always sidestep. I'd say, what do you care?
Ah, I love that. I love that. So now, you're looking back. What would you say was the hardest portion during your life?
Public school, high school. I remember one time in public school, we had to read aloud. Teacher said, everybody's going to read aloud, before the term is out and whatever. And it came to be my turn. And I truly fumbled through the whole thing. And the teacher said, Mrs. Johnson, I remember her name. Mrs. Johnson said, Jerry, sit down. Let Johnny show you how to do it. That was devastating. I had one other devastating moment. And my brother did this to me. On Passover, you sit down and you read from the 10 questions. And I had studied my question to a fare thee well, so I could do it. And my brother went before me. So he read his question and my question. And now I have a couple, now I'm with another question. So that wasn't good. My whole family then knew this.
Now, what are some mistakes you made along the way? Like, what would you say are some of the biggest mistakes you've made along the way?
Listening to people. Trusting people. It's a very difficult thing when you go into business and you don't know who you're going with or who's there, right? So you take them at their word. And even if it's in a contract, you take them at their word. And then they break their word. But they break their word and the contract is there, but they go ahead and use their power. So their power is their staying power. They can go to court and stay forever fighting that contract. So that's one of the worst moments. I won. I didn't have the money to do it, but I won.
How'd you go about winning?
Picking very good lawyers and making them make mistakes.
Now that you have a lot more experience, is there a way to identify people who you shouldn't trust? Like, were there giveaways now that you look back?
No, you never know who you can't trust. That doesn't say you can't pick good people. But push comes to shove, people break and do things you don't expect. I mean, because you ask the question, how do you know? You don't know. That doesn't mean, you know, you can't do business with people you have to protect yourself in writing. Never do verbal agreements because you're really testing it.
That is good to know. What would you say was one of the good moves? What are like the best moves that you've done now that you look back?
I married my wife.
Good move.
That was a real good move. But I should be in business.
No, this choosing a good spouse is one of the most important things you could do. I've seen great people be held back or ruined because they did not have a good spouse, right? That is someone you spent time with. That is someone that you discuss a lot of things with. That is someone who's there when push comes to shove. So having someone who isn't supportive or who doesn't uplift you makes a big difference, especially in business.
By the way, I didn't say she uplifts me, but she does support me and she does, I guess she does uplift me.
Yeah. So what about in business? What was one of the best moves you made?
Changing what I was building on the Bowery to the Bowery Hotel. Originally, I was building, first of all, there was a gas station.
Yeah.
A two-story gas station. And I was building a dormitory on the first floors. And the reason I was building a dormitory is because zoning will allow twice as much square footage if you're building a dormitory.
Okay.
I don't know if that's still the same, but that was the case. And residential. It's still a 17-story building. One day I just had dinner in Balthazar, and I had a feeling about the place and a feeling about what's going on in the Bowery, on the Bowery itself. I had missed the meatpacking district. I just never thought it would work, and I totally missed it. So this was going to be my meatpacking district. So I decided to make it a hotel and brought in some of the best hotel operators and partners. And that was that.
Now, looking back, if you, and this is an interesting question, and this, if you saw a 15 to 18 year old version of yourself walking across the street today, what would you tell him?
Trust his instinct. Get a drizzler. And then trust your instinct in the next and the next and the next and the next. It's all vision. It's all seeing something that's not there. And that's what I would tell him. I would get into the specifics. But, yeah, like this. Can you see this?
Yeah.
Okay. That's the Apple Watch. The Apple Watch sells a billion watches. Okay. This is called the slide. It'll stand up this way. And it's very simple. So now tell me how to get to Apple. But that's something that, you know, was a vision. It actually was a vision from the Nano. You remember the Nano? The Nano?
The iPod Nano, yeah.
Yeah, I made this for the Nano. Now I have this patented for design and utility. So we'll see.
Yeah, all right, let's see. If I meet Tim Cook.
When you see it on the street, you'll know it work.
Yeah. If I get an intro to Tim Cook. I said I'll try to get you an intro to Tim Cook. I can't promise much, but I'll try.
I'm trying. I want to sell Apple, the watch band, the book, and the screenplay.
That would be a nice trifecta.
Yeah, that would be a good one, right?
So what keeps you dreaming? You know, like what keeps you going still?
Everybody asks that question. I like creating. I like designing. Kind of gets me, it gets the juices going. At this stage, I think that's would be enough to get the juices going. I can't do canasta. I can't do, golf is also a misnomer to me. Like talking to you is a kick to get the juices going.
No, look, this is a kick for me. I love talking to people about their life stories and how they went through the ups and downs.
So your show is called No Degree.
The No Degree Podcast.
And the reason for that is?
I interview people without college degrees like you and have them share their stories.
It's very fair.
Yeah, and keep it simple. And I really want to thank you for this interview because my goal is to inspire the 15-year-old version of you. You know, I hope someone like that is listening to this episode to realize that it is possible.
Just so you know, I'm available because I agree with you. It's a great goal. Just a great goal. Too many people look at 15-year-olds and kids as being troublemakers. And there's not enough direction that they're getting from their parents. Nothing against parents.
That's just what parents do.
Yeah. That's true. It was a pleasure.
Definitely a pleasure.
Another great episode. Thank you for listening. Hopefully this information was valuable and you learned a lot. Stay tuned for the next episode. This show is sponsored by you. No Degree wants to remain free from influence so that we can talk about the topics without bias. If you think the show is worth a dollar or two, please check out our Patreon page. Any amount is appreciated and will go towards making future episodes even better. Follow us on Instagram or Snapchat at No Degree Podcast, on Facebook at facebook.com/No Degree, Inc. If you want to personally reach out to me, connect or follow me on LinkedIn at Junaid Iqbal, spelled J-O-N-A-E-D, last name I-Q-B-A-L. Until next time, no degree, no problem, nodegree.com.